hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Well, welcome back to Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, the commentary podcast where, well, I seem to have taken over introducing this episode because the person who should be introducing it is Joe Ford, the actual host. My name is Simon Moore, and I'm the guest for this story that we're doing, which is the absolutely awesome, utterly spectacular Terror of the Zygons, and we are about to look at episode 2.
That was adeptly done. I was just taking a swig of water there. That's why you were taking over my duties. Actually, I think given that you intro, you're now the host and I am now the guest. Well, look, shall we skip straight into episode 2? The cliffhanger was so amazing. I think we should see where it picks up. Let's go then in 3, 2, 1. Off we go.
Is this your absolute... My Blu-ray remote has worked.
Sorry. They can be tricky at times. Is this your favourite title sequence? I know that's an obvious question.
Okay. I think in trying to be objective about it, I think it is. I do love the season 11 time title sequence because I do love a John Pertwee-shaped time tunnel. And that was because Planet of the Spiders episode 2 was the first episode I ever saw. So that was... And then it took ages for them to go back and do another Pertwee again. So that was always the Pertwee title sequence for me in my head. But I think for simplicity and what the show represents, I think you can't get away from this Tom Baker title sequence. Because much as I love the music of the Davison era, it doesn't reflect the time travel correctly. Whereas this is that old fashioned time tunnel.
Spiders 2 was your first Pertwee.
Yeah. So I worked out it was after the would have been season 16 being shown on the first broadcast for us. And so that's 1979. And then they go back as they do to, they were showing just the 625 line Pertwees back in the day. And so I caught the very end of that, which was Planet of the Spiders 2, because, well, just reasons. I was being minded by someone because Mum and Dad were at the symphony or the ballet or something, and that's where I was introduced for the first time. And literally, I watched every episode after that.
You must have thought every Pertwee story was a self-indulgent chasing after that.
Well, it was kind of interesting because they were able to explain. The person I was watching it with was able to explain to me who all the characters were, and I remember getting confused between Lopton and the Doctor because they both kind of had grey hair. Anyway.
My friend Mark Doddick was chilled to the bone by the fact that Sister Lamont looks very like his mother. He's Scottish as well. So every time he watches this, he gets the chills that his mother's there murdering people and behaving in a sinister way.
But at the risk of sort of looking at sort of gender stereotypes, and especially back in that era, I mean, should we be concerned that she has this kind of slightly lesbian look because she's got a very masculine haircut and very sort of waxed down hair, and therefore because she's got that lesbian look, therefore she's evil? Do you know what I mean? It's a bit unfortunate.
I don't know if they were thinking on those lines at this point though.
Well, probably not, but who knows. Now we have to correct something we mentioned during the first episode, because my husband has informed us in between episodes that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest doesn't come out until November of 1975, so this would have been filmed this would have definitely been filmed before they saw that. So it's quite impressive that they have a kind of a similar looking and styled character. Evil nurse, yeah. But with that kind of almost same look. And I love the way the Zygon, I mean, look at those Zygon hands on this, on those dials. They're just so, this way, it's so refreshing to have the monster hands be dexterous enough to be able to operate things.
It's unusual.
So it's a glove rather than, yeah.
When the Doctor says that he picked up this trip in a minute from a Tibetan monk, suppose when we worked with the Doctor during the Abominable Snowmen that this is what he was up to?
Possibly. Well, remember, he'd already been to Det Sen Monastery. Not Det Sen. Is that Det Sen Monastery? Yeah. He'd already been there.
Oh, and so it's a sequel
to something that we never saw. Zygons.
According to Philip Hinchcliffe, originally Douglas Canfield wanted like a psychedelic series of lights for this set. And somebody pointed out that, no, that's going to look like a disco. We'll go with greens and reds. I'm pleased they did.
This, I mean, that's supposed to be Sister Lamont. No, that, well, that's the caber. No, so no, we must make this planet. I mean, just the mouth is just so brilliant. And I hate to say it now, looking at it on a large television, like upscaled for this screen, you can actually see the gap between John Woodnut's mouth and the costume. But back
the
in
the
day,
the more they clean up these productions, Simon,
the worse it is. I'm sick of like looking at the Romans and seeing the fact that they've got like, you know, a black Glad bag in the fountain. You know,
it's the cyclorama in the Mind Robber for me. Which on VHS you could never see that.
You could never see the line
of the floor, but now
the
you
line
can.
Of the floor, but now you can. So it's like no. Sometimes bad resolution is something to be thankful for.
Detail in that Zygon mask with all the veins on the head and things like that, like they really put some effort into that.
Yes, and as we said before, it's been spritzed, it's wet, it's got this moistness to it, which I don't know, why didn't the 21st century Zygons have that kind of moisture to them?
Do you know what
that model of the Zygon spaceship, just a brilliant model, sorry.
It's exactly the same as what happened with the Sontarans. Lynx had a very moist head, and then with every subsequent story, they got drier and drier and rubberier.
And also the lips had a sort of a moisture to them and there were bits of hair in places which made them look a bit gross and so on, like little just tiny tufts of hair. Whereas, they're just like, you know, clean shaven now.
Elizabeth Sladen says in her autobiography that, you know, you can put on a costume and it basically the character's there, you know. Well, I think John Woodnut's put on that costume. he embodies it, doesn't he? There's no concessions that he looks ridiculous.
No.
And that's how you do it.
But it's I hate to say it is acting 101. Regardless of how ridiculous the line is, regardless of how ridiculous the setting is, if you play it with conviction, you bring people with you. And this is what I keep going on about the suspension of disbelief, is that, you know, it's obviously you're watching a television program. And back in the day, you know, it's on a small set in the corner of the room, probably with slightly dodgy reception. And that obviously hides a multitude of sins, as we were just discussing. But, you know, it's the fact that everyone's believing it, so you believe it. As soon as they stop believing it, you stop believing it. And so it just looks ridiculous. If they think it's ridiculous, you think it's ridiculous. And even look at this with Tom. Tom's got this bit of moisture, like he's got his a bit of whatever it is on his face. Like he's I don't know what it is, but
It's worth noting as well, I've done enough of these sort of 70s stories now with people that watched them at the time, that even though colour licences came in the early 70s, a lot of people were still watching this in black and white.
In black and white, right.
And I can only imagine up until, I think Toby Haydock said he didn't go to colour until sort of 18 or something like that. So,
oh dear God, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
A bit behind the times. But I can only imagine this is even more atmospheric in black and white.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why it was great, you know, seeing some of those Pertwees in the 86 run that we got here, things like Ambassadors of Death, Silurians and Terror of the Autons and stuff, they were all shown in black and white. There's still a part of me that thinks, oh, Ambassadors of Death is so much better in black and white.
Yeah, I'm the same with Invasion of the Dinosaurs Episode 1. Exactly the
right,
same.
Yeah. It's there for a reason.
John Levine. Have you met John Levine?
I have. A few years ago now, he came out to a couple of conventions in Australia in the 90s that we were organising. He was a lovely, lovely, well, he is. He's still with us, isn't he? Yes. Lovely fellow. Absolutely lovely fellow. And funny. Because we used to, when we were doing conventions in the 90s, we'd do these plays, these comedy plays, absolutely taking the piss out of Doctor Who. And we'd always get the guest to have a cameo in one scene. So you had Mary Tam come on with like the tracer to discover that someone was the key piece of the segment of the Key to Time. And John Levine came on and I was playing Patrick Troughton in this play. And it was absolutely hilarious.
Did anybody film that?
Went with it so much. Yes, there are. I regret to say there are video copies.
Right.
And in fact,
once
Nathan
this goes out, put it on Twitter, all right? Once this goes out. He's so alien in his early seasons. I know that's a weird thing to say, but, you know, no. Peter Davison, he went a lot more sort of naturalistic.
Yeah.
He's unpredictable. He's
got the freakiness with the eyes and, you know, and just that little movement with the neck, and he's almost threatening the way he puts his hands up to her neck, but gentle. And
well, it looks like he's going to go and snap her neck, doesn't he?
Yeah, it does.
And then he mocks Mr. Benton by going, well, why are you whispering? When he started
whispering
in the
first place. Exactly. That's kind of an old gag in those kind of things. Why are you whispering?
Oh, we get our first shot of the Scarisan head in a second, don't we?
With the googly eye. I haven't got the updated effects on mine. So. Here we go. Oh no, this is the, and again, this, I mean, this is what I imagined when I was like, you know, I loved watching this story when it was, you know, in the sort of the winter time here. And so you could watch it like in the dark when it was a bit colder and you might have some mist or something. And then you could, it really added to the atmosphere of it.
I love this the short in the second head. Where they're looking at the soldier. The soldier's been trampled by the Scarisan and we never get a look at him. And what's in my imagination is far worse than anything they could put on the screen. I think that's an effective way of doing horror in Doctor Who.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's that roof that you were so fond of in the first thing. It's amazing. Which allows them, obsessed. Of course, to have that shot. No, you're absolutely right. I'd never noticed it before. And it allows the shot to be lower looking up at them because it's from the perspective of the Brigadier or Huckle or whatever lying on the floor. And so it's that kind of thing that Canfield does. It's not showy. It's just right.
You do a run through of Doctor Who again, yeah, and do a ceiling watch, and you tell me how many you see. It's not many.
Very few, I imagine. Very few.
We indeed. Are pointing and shooting in one direction for the most
in
part.
In one direction, yeah. But that's sort of theatre, really. I mean, they're basically filming a stage play most of the time, particularly in the
which
early
does
days.
Give it an intimacy. I especially love it in the '60s.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, now what they can do with next to nothing.
What do you think about these similarities between Terror of the Zygons and the Android Invasion, which DWN also spelt out in around about the same time as when the kids watched this? The plot similarities.
In terms of the duplicates thing, the duplicates aspect, or...
And the scene set in the pub, the bug there.
True.
There was quite a bit when you looked at it in some detail.
That's actually true. And they're actually only, because thanks to this being shown as part of season 13, they're actually only a few stories apart, aren't they? But yeah, in fact, maybe I even back in the day, saying confused is too strong a word, but I always had a close association between this story and an Android Invasion, probably for that reason. And especially because like the Kral's base is kind of similar to this in look and feel and they're kind of green rather than red, but you know, and you've got, you know, duplicates, as we say, but different. Oh, look, I don't know. Never bothered.
Oh, the big twist in that is that it's a duplicate Earth, isn't it? It's not really about the characters.
Exactly.
That's the big twist there. Whereas exactly. Here, it's like, it's that old Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Who do we trust? But
yes,
done
exactly.
Brilliantly.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's even a judicious use of CSO in a minute when the Zygon turns into the Kaber. And even that, I don't think looks pony.
No, it doesn't. It's perfectly fine. I mean, you know, here we go. So cut to Harry, so we can cut back to a clean shot. Well, that's because there's very little background there, and there is fringing. There is, I mean, fair enough. There is fringing, but it's not the fringing that you'd have noticed on like a dodgy. You might have noticed that fringing around his head.
When a Zygon turns into a duplicate, their fringing is all part of the process. Okay.
Yeah. But look, that's as the CSO, like if you compare that to the CSO in the Green Death, for instance, yeah, this is great. Oh, you know, I mean, just the meeting hall.
I do like the sort of investigative nature of the first two episodes of this. You know, the oil rig's being smashed, the teeth marks in it. The signaling device, which then leads to the Scarisan attacking the Doctor. It's like an A to B to C, but it does work.
Yeah. And this is the kind of plot development that I miss about the new series. I mean, yes, we have two passes in the new series, but in most instances, they're kind of two linked episodes, especially as the series gets going. It's only something like The Impossible Planet or Human Nature where you get a kind of or Silence in the Library, where you get kind of a progression of events. And I think it just makes you feel epic. It makes you feel like you're actually on a journey with them, learning things rather than everything kind of being in this frantic rush.
Would it surprise you to know that those two are two of my favourites in the new series as well. But then I'm a classic series fan, so yes.
Well, ditto. Obviously. But I'm not saying the new series is not capable of brilliance. But those are amongst my favourites.
They do get to the point very quickly, though, don't they? The pre-title sequence often does the work of episode one in the classic series.
Yeah. And I think there's just something to be said for this kind of I mean, you see, I don't want to call it, I mean, this is not slow. I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, you watch a Hartnell Six Parter or something, you know, they are slow, where, you know, they're just walking around a microscopic set in episode one. This is not slow, but it builds. It allows you to breathe and wonder what's going on and work out. See, the thing that you used to do when you'd go to school, you know, after watching an episode, even if it had been a repeat, is you talk to your friends about what had happened and what is going to happen next. What do you think is going to happen next? And you don't get that opportunity anymore. And I think that's sad. You don't get that opportunity to think and pause and allow your imagination to take you to places that the story might not take you, but nevertheless, it inspires that imagination.
You know what's sad?
Oh, I love the pen because and the mouth.
I need to talk about this, but I came in season 26 and I only watched one episode and then the show went off air. So I've never had that. Oh, what's going to happen next conversation? Because I never do it with the new series.
Yeah.
Can we please talk about Ian Marta in this scene?
Who is? They've asked me to collect it. I mean, brilliant. He's so obviously a different character. You know, it's not important. I mean, just awesome. He's so good. I wish he'd have done longer. His stories.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I said season 13 was a favorite, but actually season 12 is probably my favorite Finchcliffe season, because I love Harry and Sarah and the way it all works and the stories that they're in. It's just so brilliant.
The trouble with that is there's two stories in 12 where he's just sort of shunted to the sidelines. I don't think he does a great deal in Genesis or in Robot. Well, the others, I think he gets a nice enough role.
Well, yeah, I see. I'm thinking of Ark in Space and Revenge of the Cybermen, which
great.
Even in Genesis, he does do stuff. He doesn't do as much as Sarah. But I think Genesis, though, you're so carried away by the other characters, you know, Nida and Davros and so on. But even Liz Sladen doesn't get the biggest role in Genesis outside of the being captured by the Thals and climbing the thing at the end of episode two.
I was about to say it's Tom's piece, but it's more Michael Wish's piece, really, isn't it?
It's Michael Wish's piece, yeah.
Now, the shots in a minute of him inside this barn in the shadows looking out at her, very scary.
Ah, now you know that these were edited by the censors in Australia.
Mm.
So the sequences in the barn, which we're coming to in a minute. I only saw them for the first time once I got I think the DVD release, because I still had an off-air copy, so I didn't bother buying the VHS.
So this is an extended version as to what you would have seen originally.
Exactly. Yeah.
What was taken out then?
So we'll come to it. So just as he's climbing up there, it's just a couple of sequences where he's menacing her with the pitchfork. So we just got. Well, it explains it's coming, the clattering, yes. And just that look on her face, like the sort of, she's such a good actress in that she can portray.
Christ, look at him.
That terror, but not in an over the top way. Yeah, so we still got all that. And he's frightened, and you're frightened. You're kind of frightened for him almost, because you can kind of, you're getting across that the Zygon inside him is actually also frightened.
Yeah. And that's our Harry. We love Harry, you know?
Exactly. And up the ladder she goes.
I think this is the scene that most explicitly does the invasion of the body snatchers thing effectively. Because it's one of our friends attacking and trying to kill one of our other friends.
One of our other friends, exactly, yeah.
And in a really sort of visceral way, with a pitchfork.
And again, listen to that music, the flutes or whatever it is. It's just so eerie and not in your face.
What I love about what Douglas Canfield does.
So what we got, from that shot there, where he's just running towards her with a pitchfork, and then all this big bit here, where he's shoving it in her face, and all that goes in the original Australian, and then it just goes to him running and falling off the top. So it's just about 4 seconds or 5 seconds there that we didn't get. It still all worked. It's not one of the cuts that looked ridiculous. And the fact that he's a Zygon when he falls, you know, when he's at the bottom on his back. Brilliant.
What's so effective about the direction there is Harry is attacking us because he's coming straight at the camera.
Yeah, exactly. Again, simple choices, but not showy, but just logical to get across the terror, get across the fear, get across the urgency of the situation.
You know, I saw those Australian censor clips and I was like, yeah, okay, I can see why some of these came out. And then there were some bits where I was like, why on earth was that inappropriate, you know?
It depends what censor was on call that day.
Simon, thank goodness they did, because that's all we've got of some of those episodes now, you know?
Exactly.
I wish they'd been a little more scared, if I'm honest.
Exactly. I always kind of dreamed that they'd say, "Oh, we'll put the whole episode aside and put those in the vault and just give you and then copy it and give you the bits without it." But unfortunately, they didn't do that. they just cut it out of the film. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So Tom Baker is about to discover the Scarisan in a second, and I really want to talk about those sequences insofar as how they're executed, because I don't think they entirely work, but I feel as if everybody is going to incredible lengths to try and make them work, and I do appreciate the effort.
Yes,
but we're not there yet. We're not there yet.
Yes, great.
Does the Brigadier have enough to do in this?
No, but I don't care. I think he's actually kind of fulfilling the role that, I mean, I imagine that he should be fulfilling, which is just kind of being a secondary background figure rather than an additional companion.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes.
It's Tom's show now, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
A bug? I love the way that Broton gets so pissed as well. He starts attacking the console, doesn't he? Like, who is this man?
Destroyed, totally destroyed.
That was incredible. Thank you. My favourite Zygon line is, "Oh, but this star."
Oh, yes. Oh, and of course, this is the clip that we see in Logopolis, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Artifact part organic.
Organic.
Come on, bring on the monster. I'm waiting.
Yes. Isn't it great to have an extra or minor character? I do think he gets a line or two. Basically, he's giving his all just behind the Brigadier.
Well, I like the fact that the bit where the Doctor says to the Brigadier, you know, you were asleep. And he's like, oh, honestly, Doctor, what an absurd idea.
And then,
his second looks at him as if to say, yeah, that's just ridiculous. As if we would do that, you know. Little details.
I'm
from Sussex, Simon. And right. This Scotland atmosphere looks decidedly like Sussex to me.
Is it actually Sussex, is it?
It is Sussex, yeah. But
how hilarious.
I tell you what, I have spent a fair bit of time in Scotland as well, and he's chosen these locations brilliantly, because this looks like Scottish moorland.
Yeah. I don't really sort of pay attention. In all the things of Doctor Who about Doctor Who that I recall, that I remember, that get embedded in my brain, like production codes get embedded, but locations don't for some reason. I don't know.
What's the production code for this one, then?
Oh, it must be A, B, C, D, E, F, 4F, I guess.
4F, yeah, I think it is. We've got so much useless information lodged in there, haven't we?
Lodged in there, and it's not going anywhere, unfortunately. But yeah, that Heather and the here's the shot that I was talking about earlier in episode one, over the top of the camera. Like, that is just a sort of a film school 101 thing, but so few of the other directors do it in those kind of situations. It just provides depth. It's not just like, here is the camera on a tripod. It's actually on the ground, you know?
But just a second ago, you had Tom Baker running towards the camera, and then he turned it around and you had him running away from it just to give it a sense of pace. Whereas a lesser director would just do a long shot of him running across the moor.
And the way he pops up through the head, behind the head, that's hilarious.
I love it. And they even do shots, right, where they filmed it like an aerial shot, looking down over the Scarisan's shoulder.
Oh, yes, they have. That's true.
So, like
this
I say,
is the moment here where he. Sorry?
No, go on.
I was just going to say, this is the bit where you think he's swearing when he takes the his hand out of his pocket.
I'm still convinced he's saying, he is, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Of all the doctors that's going to swear.
And there's the Scarisan's head that you love and adore. Oh, look, you know, it's fine. It's, you know.
Nathan said it reminded him of his evil old dog, because it has got the jaw of a dog in there, I think.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. Investigation. No. We don't want this. We want more action. Go back.
Yeah. No, but it's great contrast, because it's quiet and they're all concentrating and they're focused and they're using pencils on maps and it's all very serious.
I just remember when I was seven, all I wanted was the monsters, you know, at 7 years old.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know what I wanted. It's difficult to... I can't remember.
There, look at that shot there from above. Monster. Like, where the hell are they shooting that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they must have had a helicopter or something. Or no, they wouldn't have had a helicopter. What would they have done? But it's actually interesting. You can see that it's actually a back projection of the on the model. So it's you can sort of see that a doctor die. Fantastic.
So exciting. Enormous.
It is brilliant.
That great jaw opening up.
Even that, yeah. And it's moist. Again, it's moist. Even though it's obviously a model, it's moist.
I mean, even at the moment, that model's kind of being shown in sections. In a second, it comes straight over the hill and you see it in all its glory.
Yeah, I think we saw a brief thing before in the of it coming over the hill. Yeah, it's not, yeah.
There's
it's
only not, one point I think
it's better than Invasion of the Dinosaurs, for goodness sake.
Quite. There's only one point where it's unforgivable, and that is when it pops his head out of the Thames at the end. And then I'm like, yeah, okay, I cannot suspend my belief any further. But
no,
you know
we're kind of screwed there.
So I'm perfectly convinced that's why we spend episodes 1 and 2 doing an investigation, and episodes 3 and 4 just learning about the plan, because when we actually see the invasion, we don't have the budget to do it.
No, but it's not an invasion. It doesn't have to be an invasion. You know, having... you know, 10,000, if there were 10,000 Zygons being CGI'd so that they were all kind of duplicated, that would not, for me, that would not make it more exciting. This is far more exciting and far more interesting the way it is. Well, that was part two.
Part two. Well, I'm going to go make a coffee and we'll start part 3.
I'm going to make a tea. Okay, I'll stop my recording.